Welcome back to another edition of Drop the Mitts Hockey Podcast, brought to you in partnership with Primetime Productions. We have an unbelievable guest here with us today. Longtime professional hockey player, tough guy, grinder, and author of the new and much anticipated Sex, Drugs, Pucks, and Souls, Bobby Robbins. Bobby, how you doing, man? Great to have you here.
Yeah, thanks so much. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on, man.
Yeah, man. Again, this new book that's coming out, man, very anticipated. A lot of people are fired up for it. I know I sure as hell am. Talk to us about it, man. What can readers expect from this savage memoir?
I mean, that's what you're going to expect. It's a savage memoir. This is actually my first time ever talking to anybody in the media or on a camera about the book. So I don't know how it's going to go, but couldn't happen with a better podcast here with you. And the book is written by me. So I know a lot of autobiographies, a lot of sports bios, especially, you know, they're cool. You hear a cool glimpse of an athlete and the story of the climb to greatness and the struggles. But oftentimes it's written through a ghostwriter. And, you know, so somebody sits down and tells a story and a professional writer writes it down. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. For some reason, I've been always been able to write. I went to school. I studied creative writing. I worked with a famous author, Andre Debuse III. He's a famous American novelist. He was my writing coach, my mentor. And so I always knew that I could write and had always been writing and was like, I'm just going to live out my life and see what happens. And my story, my hockey journey ended up being this insane journey that I went on. And so what makes my book really stand out is I wrote this myself. Like I went deep and I extracted these sentences artistically from the great mystery, the great unknown. And, yeah. And it turned out to be a savage memoir. It's not just a memoir. It's a savage memoir. And, I mean, what can you expect? What's this book about? Fighting my way to the NHL, losing it all, a sexual journey, potent drugs and visions, a spirit quest, my life. A savage effing story. So that's the copy on the back of the book. Kind of gets the reader enticed a little bit there. And I don't think anything's ever been done like it before. And you know, to be honest with you, I don't really know how to talk about it quite yet. I don't know like how much to give spoiler alerts and everything. But the one thing that I've come up with is a way to describe it would be if the catcher in the rye and Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas got into a hockey fight.
No shit.
That would give you love sex, drugs, pucks, and souls. So,
dude, like I said, I think oftentimes we see like, you know, all we hear about is the rise, right? We don't hear about the, you know, we hear about the highs. We don't necessarily hear about the lows or the in-betweens, right? And I think that's something a lot of people are really anticipating and excited for is, you know, you really open up and a lot of people aren't necessarily open to doing that. And you, it seems like with this book, you know, you put it all out there. You talk about, again, the lows, the in-betweens, not just the highs of making it to the NHL, because a lot can happen, man. I mean, life is a crazy thing. And I think that's what people are, you know, really excited for, seeing that other side of, you know, a professional athlete. But, man, 2005, 2006, you served as the captain of UMass Lowell. While, again, you mentioned you were going to school for creative writing. You know, did you ever envision that this path would lead you, to consider writing a book at some point? And if so, like, what was the primary, like, reason behind this ambition?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, for sure, all my buddies will tell you, like, you know, I was just talking to my buddy the other day. He's like, man, 20 years ago, you were talking about writing this book. I know. I was like, it took a little longer than expected here, but yeah, I always knew it, man. When I was young, I was writing. I was getting poems published in magazines and newspapers. And I always wanted to do two things. I wanted to be a hockey player and I wanted to be an author. And, you know, for a big chunk of my life, hockey really took over, but I was always writing and I was always, always dreaming like, you know, someday I'm going to write that book, but I didn't really, you know, I put all my focus into hockey. And then when my career was over, I was like, all right, this is it. And I, you know, it took a bunch of years to finally get into a good rhythm and to figure out how to really extract these sentences and put it together. But yeah, I mean, I just always knew it. I knew, and I talk about that in the book. I knew when I was studying writing at Lowell, I was like, I'm going to write a crazy story. And I was always into crazy, like wild madman stuff. I like to read books that, you know, put you over the edge and take you right up to that edge. And I was like, I want to write a book like that. But I was scared to do it for a lot of years. I was like, man, what? I don't want to say too much. I don't want to, you know, I just want to keep it right down the middle of the road. But eventually, through some circumstances in my life, I said, I'm going all in on this. I got one life to live, and I'm gonna put it out there. And it formed into this savage memoir.
Fuck yeah.
And yeah, man. So it's it goes all the way back to even before Lowell. Just always wanted to do that, and kind of having a big dream, like almost like a pipe dream. But then seeing it come together at Lowell, UMass Lowell English department is amazing. And they have some pretty established writers on their staff. And I was able to work with a novelist. And that's when it became real for me. I was like, I can do this. And with his encouragement, he's saying, you know, you have it. You have what it takes. You have that, whatever that skill is. You just have to hone it and actually become a professional at it. So I knew it then. And then it was just living out a long 10-year hockey career. And then it just all came together in a magical way.
You know, you had mentioned that it took you a little bit to kind of really decide, like, fuck it, I'm going all in, right? Like, was that more so like fear of like what people would think about you? Like, what was the like rationale behind that? Like, and then at what point did you just decide, like, you know what, who gives a shit? Like, yeah. Like you said, man, I got one life to live. This is a crazy story that tons of people are going to be able to, like, they're going to be interested in, for one, and then two, potentially learn something from, right? Like, at what point did you kind of just decide, like, you know, I don't give a shit what people think. Like, this is my life. This is my story. You know what? Take it or leave it.
Yeah. I mean, it took a bunch of years. I'd been writing this book for about 7 years and just, you know, it started taking form. And I guess the point where I said, screw it, I'm going for this was, I was just trying to figure out my life. I mean, if I can be honest, I haven't really found my stride since my hockey career ended. You know, I've done a lot of stuff. I've taught in schools. I've coached hockey. I've worked in ministry. I've worked behind a desk in a cubicle, and I never really found my stride. And I was watching this interview with Charles Bukowski, a famous author who writes some pretty wild stuff, madman stuff. And he said that he's like, you know, I was either going to write what I write or I was going to go work at the factory. Yeah. And, you know, I have a family, I have 3 kids and I have a wife. And I was like, I want to provide for my family. Can I do this as a writer? Can I do this as an author? And I was like, I'm not going to be able to do it playing it safe, just like my hockey career. I think for a lot of my career, I tried to play it safe and not really put myself out there and just kind of squeak by in the middle of the pack. And it wasn't until I finally said, screw it, I'm going to do this. I'm going to fight. I'm going to become the guy that everyone's cheering for. I'm going to do this. You know, this is my destiny. And I kind of had that mentality in this writing process too, where I was like, I'm not only am I going to write something crazy, I'm going to write the craziest book. I'm going to put you over the edge, you know? Yeah. And it was when I got that mentality. And I think a lot of that stemmed from just sitting in a cubicle, working a corporate job that I literally hated. And I was like, this is not what I want to do for the rest of my life. And I saw this opportunity. I was like, I've been given a gift of this story that I have, this savage tale, and I've been given the talent. It's a God-given ability to be able to write it. I was like, shame on me if I don't do it. And a big part of it was worrying about what people are going to think. I mean, it'd be so cool to write the story like, hey, I fought my way to the NHL and I'm a champion, you know? Yeah. But my story is like, I fought my way and clawed and scratched and I squeaked out 3 games and I'm grateful for those 3 games, but I had a massive fall, man. And it almost devoured me. And there was madness and insanity and all and everything in between. And it was like, man, I think I'm going to talk about this stuff. I think I'm going to really get deep into this, into drugs. And I was like, what are my interests? Like, it's sex, drugs, pucks or hockey and souls, just finding out who I am, what my purpose is. And I was just like, could I write this? And I had this like a seed planted in my mind that there was a way to write this in this savage way. And then it was like, you know, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? And I just started writing one sentence at a time over, you know, really giving it 3 years of really digging in. And then all of a sudden I looked on my desk and it was like, it was this. It was a manuscript. I was like, I did it, dude.
Yeah.
But then it was like, how does this form into a book? And so it's been a big learning curve to figure out this whole new thing. I'm learning this whole process on my own. And, you know, I have some good help showing me the ropes and everything, but it's just been a process. And I guess back to your question is, it was just saying, hey, I got one life to live and this is my shot. I'm either going to write something great or, you know, I know what's waiting for me if I don't. So
yeah,
I'm running from that cubicle as hard as I can. And, and it's not just about finances and providing for my family though. I want to make an impact and I want to make an impact on young men especially. And so I really talk a lot about, you know, sexual things and addiction and, you know, especially guys in the hockey world, we're steeped in that. So it's the real deal. And I just wanted to put my heart and soul, my balls out there and be like, here I am. Like, I don't care. If you don't like it, read it anyway. But
yeah, you read it. Yeah. But you know, even during your creative process, like what other like struggles did you go through? Like, I feel like, you know, a lot of people that, you know, there's struggles that you can face on the ice, but this author and this writing route, like it's hard to, you know, like what struggles did you go through during this whole process that people might not think about, that, you know, things that were really tough while doing this?
Yeah. I mean, it was a struggle. I mean, it was a slow grind and there were ebbs and flows to it. And some days it was going great. Other days it was like, this is the stupidest thing. I mean, one day I had this manuscript here. My poor wife has seen me in this whole artistic process. I just took this one day, like right as I had finished it, and I threw it all over my, it exploded everywhere. And I was like, I'm done. I'm throwing it in the garbage. You know, I'm just done with this. And so I think a lot of it was just doubt. I think doubt coming from internally saying, can I really do this? And, you know, what's it going to be like if I do? And trying to picture that reality of what would happen if I did. And then I think there was doubt from people, you know, I've been telling my family and friends this since I retired in 2016. I was like, I'm going to write a book. I'm going to write a book. And so now we're going on 8 years and nothing had happened. And, but yeah, I mean, it's here now and just looking back on it, some of the struggles were, was just trying to figure out how to even do it. You know, for it in the beginning, it seemed like such a daunting process to put together a book. But now that I've done it, I think I have a pretty good grasp on how to do it. And like I said, it's like that elephant analogy. It's just a little bit at a time. And
right.
I had to take what I learned in my hockey career, which brought me success, was like doing all the things that are going to move you in that direction, even the stuff when no one's looking. You know, it was like I was in the gym and stretching and foam rolling. And now as an author, it's like, all right, I need to sharpen my sword here. I need to be writing every day and I need to really sit down and make this a priority. But I think the biggest struggle was the same old adversary, was fear for me, fear of failure and maybe fear of success and maybe fear of just putting myself out there like balls exposed, you know, here I am. And so that's what this book is. So it was, during this process, I ended up writing a children's book, like a sweet little children's book. And I was like, I'm just going to publish a children's book instead. Like, I don't want to do this other one. But it was just, that was all just fear of what was holding me back from really putting this story out there. Because this is, I think, I truly believe this is going to affect lives and make a big impact. It's a heavy book. So
I had mentioned to you, man, like when we kind of announced that you were coming on the pod and you had made that post, I probably had about 15 DMs of people that were like, and people I had never met. It looked like they were hockey fans, you know, they would have Bruins in the bio or whatever, and just, you know, fired up, Bobby wrote a book. And it's like, yeah, like it's going to be legit. And they were just so fired up for it, man. And like, again, it's just you being real. And I think that's what people are going to appreciate most, is like you putting it all out there. I know it's definitely an anticipated book. And I got to ask, man, with your first book coming out, you know, soon, do you have any thoughts on potentially keeping it going and continuing to write?
Oh, 100%. This is what I want to do from now on. So, I have about 4 or 5 books down the pipeline here, and I don't know which one I'm going to really commit to next, but yeah, I mean, I'm going to probably take the next a good solid year of just promoting and selling this book and traveling around. But when the time comes, I'm just kind of feeling the frequency and the vibration of, I don't want to force it, but there's about five in there that are percolating right now. So this is what I want to do. I mean, I started my own publishing imprint, Rotterdam Books.
Awesome.
So I'm going to publish all my own books. I took a big kind of a page out of the book, no pun intended, from a punk rocker named Fat Mike. I don't know if you know Fat Mike from NoFX.
Fat Mike, yeah.
I grew up listening to punk rock, man. I was a skater punk, and I was always a fan of the DIY ethic, do it yourself, and not having any gatekeepers, not depending on anyone. And I always liked what Fat Mike did when he started Fat Records and started publishing his own CDs through NoFX and other bands. And so that was my inspiration with Rotterdam. I wanted to start Rotterdam and publish all my own books. And then who knows what'll happen to open it up. I know there's a lot of stories out there, and I'm interested in publishing like real raw stories puked up from the heart and the guts and the soul, like the real deal stuff.
Now, like, have you always had that kind of like entrepreneurship, like mindset, like knowing that you wanted to do it yourself and like build something from the ground up? Is that something that's kind of new that's come as you were working on this book?
I've always had that. Even when I was playing, I had a website back in the day in 2011, 2012, Bobby Robbins blog. So I was writing on there and I was selling some autographed pictures and stuff, and always envisioned a podcast that never transpired yet. We'll see what happens.
Yeah.
I've always just had I've had a appreciation for working for yourself and not having a boss and just providing for yourself and being your own man. So, and especially with technology now, to be able to do that. And, I'm talking to you on an iPhone right now, and that's intriguing to me. And then especially as a writer too, to be able to just, I was always into the digital nomad lifestyle.
Yeah.
And having a laptop and running that thing on there. And so, yeah, I've always have wanted to do that. And now it's kind of like I'm literally looking at a stack of 300 shipping boxes. It's like this, like a 5 foot tall stack. I'm like, oh man, this is real now. I'm really doing this. Like we're taking orders and we're shipping our own books.
Unreal,
and
man.
We're like, let's do this here until we have to rent a warehouse. Let's do the warehouse until we got to rent a staff or we got to hire a staff, And so we're just,
that's so sick.
I got my wife on board and she's a genius actually, marketing and computers and stuff. So we're a pretty good team. And yeah, man, I've always wanted to do it. And it's weird to think that here we are now.
Real. Man. That's how it works, man. And like, I think the most inspiring thing is you've tried multiple things, right? And I think it's something that a lot of people can resonate with is you mentioned the desk job, you mentioned all these different things, and you just were like, I fucking hate my life. Like, this is not what I want to do. And I think so many times people are so afraid to take that jump, right? Because it's uncomfortable. And again, it's not a safe move to bet on yourself, right? And like, anything can go through your mind, man. Like, how am I gonna fuck up? Like, what if I mess this up? Like, and again, you're living proof that you bet on yourself, and sure as shit, man, you got a friggin' book out of it. So it's unbelievable. It's something that a lot of people are gonna resonate with.
And that was a big thing, was betting on myself. I'm like, I knew I could write, I knew I had a story, and I was like, I think I can write that diamond. And I spent some time talking to people in the industry and telling them. It's always one thing when you tell somebody, "Ah, man, I'm going to write this book. It's just the best book ever, man." And I, going back to my hockey career, after my fourth year pro, I came back, and I get into it in the book. We can talk about it too if you want to go down the hockey road. But
yeah,
I was overseas, sitting in Slovenia, sitting on the bench, riding the pines, and I was like, "What?" I was literally the worst player in the league, in the Austrian league. And I just wasn't even playing. And I was like, I hate my life. What's happening? Why was I a pussy? And why didn't I fight when I was on an NHL contract? It was fear is a big part of a theme that I was facing in my life and in this book. And at my fifth year pro is when I came back to North America and said, I'm going to do it. I'm going to fight my way to the NHL. And so I called up a bunch of agents and like coaches in the American League and the East Coast. I told them, I was like, hey, I'm like almost 30 years old. I'm like, hey, I've trained with a fighter. I learned how to fight for real. I'm going to fight my way to the NHL. I could just tell. I was like, you can tell when somebody believes in you and when they don't. They're just like, yeah. And I mean, I eventually one agent believed in me and a coach did. But it's the same thing with this, you know, and that's what I did. Like, I knew what I was going to do, but, you know, talk is cheap, right? And
right.
So early on in this process, I was calling people and, you know, in the industry and like, I got this book, man. And it's, I got the first three chapters written and they're just like, okay. And that was a moment where I said, I'm just going to do this. I'm just going to do this myself. You know, and screw everybody else if they don't believe in me, you know?
Yeah, dude. It's so funny you bring up that, because it was in my notes, literally, I had noticed you went overseas, right? And we can get into that too, like if you have any crazy stories you want to tell about your time overseas. But man, I noticed you come back to the States, 2012 to 13, you got 316 penalty minutes, right? 2013, 2014, 221. 2010, 2011, 186. So like, that was my exact question. Like, what changed when you came back? Like, and I'm so glad you told that story, but like, was it just the fact that like, I'm done being a not that you were a pussy, but like, were you like, oh yeah, like, no, this, I'm going all in on this fighting and grinder thing.
Yeah, man, it was, and this is a lesson that I've learned, and hopefully you can take it, or anybody listening can take it. I wish I would have known this earlier. It's when you finally decide to go all in, like there's, and like going back to with talk is cheap. You know, you can say you're all in, but you know, for me as a hockey player, I was like, oh yeah, I'm all in. And I was training hard, man. I was giving it everything I have. But the reality is, early in my pro career, as I was being molded or pressured into that fighter role, I literally, on my first year, my first NHL contract with Ottawa, in my exit meeting with some scouts, they said it straight up, like, hey, if you're going to play in the league, the American League or the NHL, you're going to have to be a guy who fights 20 to 25 times a year. Like, that's who you are. And inside I knew it, but in my mind I was like, oh, they don't know I'm a player, I can be a goal scorer. And so that was always this conflict I was having in my head throughout my hockey career, was just this fear, literally a fear of fighting. And I was a pussy. I would black out sometimes on the ice and just destroy somebody in a fight or something. But I never fought any heavies, like true fighters, because I was genuinely just scared. I go deeply into that fear aspect in the book. And it was after my fourth year pro living in Slovenia in the Austrian league, where my career was over. It was just, it wasn't going anywhere. I didn't play. I just, you know, sat the bench. And that was when I really got pissed off. And I said, man, I got pissed off at myself, really. I was like, man, why was I so scared? You know, I was sitting watching all the guys who I played with in the American League, who are now in the NHL, guys like Aaron Voros or Dan Carcillo, and I don't know who else, a bunch of other guys, Patrick Coletta, all these guys who are checkers, you know, and kind of gritty fourth line, third, fourth line guys in the American League. That's who I was, but I wasn't fighting the same way they were. They were fighting legit. And it was finally when I was over there and I just said, man, I saw this pathway open up. And this was when a lot of the big one-dimensional goons were getting phased out of the game. Yeah. And I don't know what year that was, maybe 2010, 2011. And I just said, I think I can be that player. And for me, it was facing fear. And at that point in my life, it was kind of like how I am now. I didn't have anything to lose. I had everything to gain. And I was like, well, this is just how my life's going to be unless I do something really, really crazy. And so I was just crazy enough to go for it and to really go all in with my words and with my actions and train to fight and learn to fight and then go do it. Like you saw the penalty minutes there. That was my goal. It's like, I'm going to fight 25 times a year. I think the 316 PIMS year, I fought 41 times and led the whole earth in fighting majors, which was pretty crazy. But yeah, I just, that was, and I'm an extreme guy. So when I was like, I'm going to fight, I was every game I was trying to fight. And every one of those fights, I think 132 of them, was just a lesson in facing fear and facing my own self-doubt and my confidence. And, but yeah, so I mean, once I decided to do that, and I went all in, then, I mean, the sky's really the limit once you really go all in with your words and with your actions and really believe in yourself that it can happen.
Yeah, man. And I'm curious, I got a question, is You know, when did you realize that you were even going to play at a professional level? Like, was there a point in time where, because obviously you're not fighting in college, right, at ULOL. At what point during, like, early in your career did you realize, like, holy shit, I have a chance to, like, maybe make something of myself as far as, like, hockey goes? Because, again, ULOL is a hell of a school. Hockey East is sick. Like, at what point did you realize you might have something here?
Yeah, there's a great scene in the book, actually, with Kim Brenvold. He's the assistant coach for Boston University right now. He was my teammate at UMass Lowell. We were classmates. And it was my junior year, and I had just had a pretty big year. I think I had 9 goals, 9 assists in 30 games, which is pretty decent for a power guy, a banger. And we were sitting after the hockey season, and we had got bounced out in the first round by Maine. And he came up to me, and he said, you know, Bobby, if you double that amount of goals next year, you'll be in the NHL. And so that was my junior year in college. And that was literally the first moment where I believed, where I saw that it was actually a possibility, and not just like, oh yeah, I want to play in the NHL, and just saying it. I was like, oh, this is something that can happen. And so I got dialed in for my senior year. I trained harder than I've ever trained. And that's really where I was growing my faith in myself and my belief that it could happen. And, yeah, so it was my junior year. Kim Brambold, great guy, assistant coach at BU. I hope they win some hardware here. That'd be amazing. But yeah, he put that belief in my mind. That seed was planted that day after our season ended, and I was like, I just got to double my goals. I was like, double your points. I had 18 points or something. I was like, okay, I can just double those. And I didn't double them, but. Got pretty close and ended up having a breakthrough senior year and led the team in scoring and was the captain and left right as soon as our season ended, left to go to the American League and then signed that summer with Ottawa. And that was just for my physicality, I think, and just my how rugged I was playing. And I didn't understand at that point yet that when you combine that type of player with the fighting, that's an NHL player who I was supposed to be. But it took me a lot of years to really realize that. And I think a lot of growth within myself and just facing my own demons and my own fears and the reality that I was living in the hockey world. It's a pretty intense reality, as we saw yesterday with the Rempe fight and McDermott. And it's no joke out there when you're fighting bare knuckles, another man, you know. And so it took me a while to really embrace that and to do that and to face that fear. But it all stems back to my boy, Cameron Brambold, for planting that seed.
Do you think that you working your ass off that after the season, right? Him putting that, lighting that fire under your ass. Do you think that ultimately was a huge reason why you were named captain, just kind of working your balls off and doing whatever it took to get better? What qualities do you think you had as a player that made you such a good captain?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was just my work ethic was always, I was always the hardest working guy. And I think if I could go back, I mean, I don't think I was a great captain. I mean, we had some good leadership and captains on our team, but I was a guy who would run you in practice. And like, I had a level of intensity that I've only met a few people that have. I think I would look down on people who didn't have that. I'd be like, why aren't you more intense?
Yeah.
And, but you know, as I grew up and learned a little bit more, I realized that everybody is different, obviously, and brings different things to the table. Like one guy might bring intensity. One guy might bring, a cool, calm and collective, element to the game. But, it was just being completely dialed in. And I was literally obsessed with success and making it to the NHL that summer going into my senior year. And, we all stayed there on campus and trained and, I just gave it everything I had. And, I mean, looking back on it, I would have not ran people in practice and been a little less, intense, but, I was just dialed in. I was a kid. I was, on the verge of manhood, about to turn pro. And it was literally the only thing I cared about, the only thing I thought about. And I think for me, I needed to have that type of obsession to reach those highest levels.
Yeah, man. And I got to ask you, man, going back to the overseas thing, because I'm always so curious, you hear these unbelievable stories about, whether it's the KHL, you were in Austria. Do you have any like crazy stories of things that happened overseas? You mentioned that you, you know, you were struggling for a bit there and you thought your career was over at one point. You know, was there a point where that kind of started like the really lows for you? Cause you mentioned right when you came back, you made that decision that, you know what, fuck it, I'm going to go all out. Do you have any crazy stories of things that happened overseas? And then, you know, again, like what do you owe your time in Austria? As far as like what it did for your development? I think you already kind of answered that, but just kind of curious what, you know, if it had any more impact on you.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of my crazy stories come from the year before Austria, from Belfast.
Belfast.
The Belfast Giants. What a year and what a
You
team.
Wore an A there too, man.
I did, yep.
Yep.
Man, that was such a cool year. That was, you know, that was my third year pro. I had just left the East Coast Hockey League. And I mean, essentially, I had given up on my NHL dream at that point and just said, I'm just going to go have fun. And I let loose and played hockey and we partied so hard. And I was single. I met my wife later that year. So, I mean, there's some crazy stories in this book. Maybe I can read some stuff to you a little later. But yeah, just the party scene was my year in Belfast where I lost all, you know, I lost my dream of the NHL, but I gained a lot of good times for sure in hitting the town and partying. And I thought my life was complete at that point. I was like, I have girls, I have drugs, I have sex, I have drugs. I have this hockey team where I'm actually a player here. And I decided I was like, I'm never going to fight again when I went over there. And the UK league's pretty tough. There's heavyweights on each team. And you know, they were always asking me to fight. I was like, no way, man, I'm not going to fight. And I just focused on being a good player. But a big moment there during my year in Belfast was when I got in a fight with Andre Payet, who passed away, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But that was a big moment for me facing fear. And it's a cool chapter in the book. But yeah, I mean, as far as craziness, you'll have to buy the book to see how crazy it really goes.
Yeah.
But that next year, so I ended up meeting my wife that summer after Belfast. And I can read that. I can read that too. That's one of my favorite parts of the book.
Be awesome.
But yeah, let me pull it up. So I met my wife, and that's when I was like, oh man, you know, I was just banging around and doing the hockey thing and chasing girls. And when I met my wife, I was like, oh, this, I think, you know, I actually love this girl. Like, could I see myself married and doing it for real? And that's when things started to shift in my mind and in my heart. I was like, I need to provide for this girl. And my initial plan was to just keep climbing the ranks in Europe and be this, you know, a goal scorer. And I signed out of Belfast in the Austrian league, which is a big jump. And I was like, I'm just going to keep moving up. Made me get to Sweden. Could I get to the KHL, you know, and start making some serious money? And that dream died pretty quickly. I actually signed in Denmark, you know, signed a deal in Denmark. And then they ended up, this was 2008 during the financial crisis. And the last day of training camp, they called all the imports in and fired all of us. They're like, oh, we don't have any money. And I was like, oh, okay. So yeah, man, I was in Denmark. There's a place called Christiania. It's this artist district. I got fired and I was just there. I was smoking pot in Denmark and like thinking about my life. There's a cool scene of that in the book. And I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do. I think I'm done. And that's when, you know, everything came together with this team in Austria. And I was like, all right, this is it. I'm going to have a great year. I'm going to provide for my wife and onto the better league. And then I never played. So it was that time in Austria where I felt that resentment, kind of resentment of everybody else, resentment of myself, really having to look at myself. And a lot of stuff happened that summer where pretty much everything fell apart. Everything fell apart. I didn't have anything. And I was in a moment where I didn't have anything to lose. And I just said, I really got pissed off, you know, and I'm like, I'm going to do it. And that was really the spark that fueled my return to North America to fight for real. And then ended up fighting my way to the NHL. So you want me to read this scene of my wife? It's so good.
Yeah. Dude, that'd be awesome. That'd be awesome.
Okay. Yeah, she's an amazing woman. She's from up here as well, and in Wisconsin. So she's one of the few people who've always believed in me.
Yeah. That's what it takes, man. I'm telling you, that's kind of what this podcast, like, very similarly, like, I was, you know, I got medically retired from the military, and I had nothing. Okay. I was drinking every day.
All right.
You know, I'd wake up, do it. And yeah, it takes that one special person that believes in you and just kind of lights a fire under your ass that you're not doing enough. Right. So I definitely understand it from that perspective.
Cool, man. Yeah. It was a big moment in my life, a change. I felt that change happen. And then here's how it all started. You want to hear it?
Yes, sir. Yep.
All right. I've never done this before, reading aloud. So we'll see how it goes.
This is awesome, man.
Yeah. So this is, give you where we're at in the story. This is, I just talked about Belfast. This is right after Belfast ended. In the fight with Payette, spoiler alert, I ended up blowing out my shoulder. So I had to get surgery in Belfast. I came back home to Wisconsin, and this is, this is what we're working with here. I get surgery in Belfast and fly back home to Wisconsin to rehab and stay at my parents' house in Peshtigo. I have a sack full of painkillers and reunite with my stash of boner pills. I meet up with my old hockey buddy who's trying to be a Buddhist monk and growing pot in his closet. He hooks me up with a massive bag of the stuff, and then everything's all right. I'm numb from head to toe, but one thing's missing. I need sex bad. The pickings are slim here in this tiny town in northern Wisconsin. I'm a depraved, pointy horn, desperately seeking something to puncture. I'm a pulsating penis with two arms, two legs, and a head full of longing and slam pig withdrawal. I don't know if I'm going to make it. I eat a bunch of painkillers and drink a few beers every night as I nurse my shoulder. When my parents go to bed, I sneak over to the window in my bedroom and take massive rips from a little vaporizer. I hold these plumes deep in my lungs and then forcibly exhale out the window so none lingers in the room. Then I sit there paranoid that the room smells like weed. I finally relinquish all control and melt into my bed. My mind races with thoughts across the spectrum of existence, from bliss and visions of majestic scenes to moments of sheer terror that there's something in the room with me. My heart thumps and beats loudly as the chemicals sludge through my veins, and anytime I feel the fear, I'm able to quench it by stuffing more tobacco into my mouth. I'm about a week away from getting out of my sling. My shoulder still hurts, but it's healing, and the physical therapy and painkillers are helping. I meet up with an old high school buddy of mine, Comper, a fiery redhead with bushy sideburns and a low, bellowing laugh that can light up a room. He invites me to a birthday party of some girl we went to high school with. It's at a bar called Stadium View across from Lambeau Field, where the Green Bay Packers play. I'm ready to get out of the sticks and head to the big city. I put on my best Belfast-worthy outfit, a tight-fitting polo long sleeve with some stylish European jeans and equally dapper European shoes, of which the Northwoods has never seen the likes of. I finish off the outfit with a funky Irish pub hat that I picked up in Dublin a few months back. I decide to wear my sling just in case, mostly to remind myself that I'm not completely healed and to not be an idiot. Who knows? Maybe it'll be a good conversation starter with the Vixens, get that sympathy treatment. I'm ready. I slide one boner pill into the secret pocket of my jeans, already visualizing vaginal success. We're already wasted when we show up to the birthday party. We sit down and take more Jaeger shots. I'm alternating between pinches of chewing tobacco and smoking cigarettes. Then those rare moments when I'm chewing tobacco and smoking cigarettes at the same time, a pro. I'm starting to feel good now when I'm not really thinking, but just reacting. Because if I try to think too hard, I'll surely topple over and take out two or three cocktail tables. I float over to the dessert spread, levitating through the partygoers. There's a bunch of birthday cake and cupcakes all stacked up on stylized trays and doilies. There's no greater feeling than the blackout drunken gorge on birthday cake. You feel that velvety texture and sweetness melt onto your tongue and slide down your throat. It plops right into your belly that's engorged with a volatile mixture of way too many kinds of alcohol, and it's all swashing around in there and coalescing into a clump of primordial vomit that will eventually emerge later in the night like some creature from the depths. That's when I see her. her bangs are cut right along her eyebrows, and she's wearing the skinniest jeans I've ever seen. And that adorable little smile, those lips are smiling right at me, right through me. My testicles are tingling as I stumble toward her. Somehow I managed to hold it all together. I've been here before, way too drunk to be having a conversation, but knowing that I can't let this opportunity pass, I think I found her, the diamond in the rough. What will I say? What will I do? The thoughts rattle around as I move toward her, putting one foot in front of the next. This is where I let the chemicals do what the chemicals do. I have no control at this point. All I know is that I've never beheld a sweeter scene in my life. This fresh, young, 21-year-old kitten with the cutest bangs and the reddest lips and the tightest jeans that hug those hips. I'm in love. I've fallen hard. She's alone and standing in front of the cupcake table, and there's literal sweetness and sugar all around. I finally get to her, and I'm just standing there looking into her eyes. She smiles and says, "Hi," and holds up a cupcake in front of her as if to say, "Here you go. Do you want a cupcake?" I lunge my face forward and eat the cupcake out of her hand in one animalistic gulp. She didn't see that coming. Neither did I. She's living at home in Peshtigo with her parents and going to college, and she's lonely and desperately wants to meet a boy. She's been praying for a good man to come into her life, and look who shows up, an absolute meat stick, but somehow she sees a glimmer of light in there, some glimmer of hope. After the cupcake incident, we talk, and there's an instant connection, those firework explosions pulsing through our bodies. In her mind, she thinks, "I'm going to marry this guy and have his babies." In my mind, I think, "I'm getting laid tonight, hundo." I try to play it cool, and a few cupcakes quickly absorb all the Jaeger in my stomach. At least I'm not falling over and not having to lean on something to keep from falling over. She tells me her name is Samantha. I don't know what happens next, but I lose her. I remember her saying something about going to the dance floor, and then I'm at the bar and doing a shot with Comper, and he's wearing my sling, and I'm playing air guitar to that Who song, Teenage Wasteland, and the room is spinning, and so I smoke a cigarette to level things out. Then I'm walking around the dance floor like Frankenstein, a meaty conglomerate of dead body parts that are coming alive from these cocktail chemicals and blaring music, chaos, thunder, and the prospect of taking this girl home tonight. But somehow on a deeper level, feeling some love chemicals and hormones pumping those sauces of cynicism out and filling my heart up with something that will bring life back to that old stone in there. There are smoke machines and lasers and lights and a frenetic maze of people. I'm pinballing around, lost on the dance floor, and have one eye open with my head tilted slightly back and to the left. I can only see out of this one eye, and if I squint it just right, I'll be able to make her out, and then hopefully make out, while we grind our hips together under the lasers and haze. I think I remember what she looks like. How could I forget those bangs and those cute little red lips? I keep squinting and bouncing around the dance floor, and I'm half yelling and half whispering, a pathetic cry out for my lost love. This soft groaning sound of out of my mouth, this slurred word of desperation, Samantha. I can't find her. I just stumble around and bump into people and walk the maze of the dance floor and lights and smoke until I finally get back to the bar and Comper's there and still wearing my shoulder sling. I order a water and hack a dart. This usually means I have about 45 minutes before I'm kneeling in front of a toilet and puking the night's memories into the bowl, sending that creature back where it belongs. The night ends with a toilet bowl massacre and a faint memory of a girl I met named Samantha and plugging her number into my phone. I'm passing out on a couch in some basement, and as the darkness closes in and envelops me in its mysterious drunken embrace, I see a light shining and taste velvety cupcakes upon my lips. That's how chapter six ends.
Holy shit, man. Dude, that's legit.
That's how I met my wife.
Like, man. Detail, man. Jesus, that's unreal. And the whole book is that like detailed.
Oh, dude, it's art, man. It's high art. It's a savage memoir. It's literature. So it's my story, but it's legit literature, and it takes you deep on a.
It's a like you're there. Adventure. It's like you're there. It's like you're there, man.
That's how I wanted to. I wrote it, you know, starting from a kid all the way up to, you know, after my hockey career ended, but I wrote it in the perspective of that, of me, the narrator, going through it at that time period, which is kind of cool.
That's insane, man. Now I'm so looking forward. And I know when people listen to that, it's going to go insane, man. But listen, I want to go back and talk, you know, about your career, man, your time playing. You know, once you got back to the States and you decided you were going to go all in with this fighter thing, your first fight, do you remember your first fight, who you went with after, you know, that your time overseas and what was going through your mind? You know, eventually you had that fire lit under your ass at that point. And do you remember that tilt?
Do I remember it? I remember it well. I wrote about it. Yeah, I wrote about it. I won't read it to you. That was a long chunk I read to you. But yeah, I trained probably about 4 or 5 months, like right down to the nuts, man, as hard as I could. And really found out what I was capable of the depths that I could go in my training. And I was just, it was like a fight against myself. You know, I was fighting myself and my doubt and my demons. And then all of a sudden it was time to fight for real. And I ended up getting a tryout with the Houston Arrows in the American Hockey League. And yeah, I'll leave a lot of the details. I'll save it for the book because it's a cool story. But man, my first exhibition game, I'm wearing a Houston Arrows jersey, and I'm like, I'm making this team. You know, I'm doing this. We're playing against the San Antonio Rampage in San Antonio, and there's three tough guys on their roster. Their entire fourth line meet. That's what it says. That's one of the sentences in the book. Their entire fourth line meet. But I was like, I'm going to fight all three of them. I was like, I'm really going to do this. I'm here, man. I'm going to fight all three of these guys. So I was picking fights and warmups, and I was scared to death, man. But I was finally, for the first time, ready to face my fear. And like the coach comes in, or the equipment manager comes in and says, hey guys, give it about 10 more minutes here. There's just the, you know, this is Texas here, so the ice still had a bunch of water on it. I'm like, oh man, this is taking forever. Yeah. And the coach comes in and talks to us. He's like, hey, we're going to give it another 15 minutes. We're just waiting for the ice to settle. Still a lot of water around the Zamboni door. And man, like, I've never had such a intense inner dialogue and conversation with myself, like having to look in that mirror. Literally sat there for an extra half an hour. And I was like, I'm doing this. Like, this is my I know this is my destiny.
Chomping at the bit, dude.
Chomping, man. I was like, come on, this is torture.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden they came in and said the game's canceled.
No.
the refrigeration died in the Texas heat. So
no.
The game got canceled. No. I was like, we drove to San Antonio, drove back. I was like, I'm gonna bring it tomorrow. I mean, I was like all positive mentality. I was like, I'm gonna have the best practice of my life tomorrow. Get to the rink in the morning. Coach calls me into the office, and I got cut that morning.
Oh my!
I was like,
God.
Oh man,
are you fucking joking?
Yeah. Oh, God, so I ended up I had a weekly contract in Bakersfield in the East Coast Hockey League, the Condors, and so I drove from Texas to Bakersfield, and I was like, at this point in my life, I knew I was like, this is just a journey I'm on. I'm on a quest. You know, I always knew I was on a quest, and I know now that I am on a quest. And I was like, all right, this is just a part of my quest. I'm going to go to Bakersfield. So I go there, and yeah, my first fight was a preseason game in Las Vegas against a big guy named Findorf, who was a savage, rookie tough guy. And I end up having a great fight. Like, I learned how to throw lefts with this guy I was training with, Gunnar Garrett, pro boxer. And I hit Findorf in the teeth with a left, and I knocked out his two front teeth, won the fight. And then I looked down, and I don't know if you can see it, but I severed my tendon in my hand with his teeth. So I was out for 3 months. So literally my comeback, go to AHL camp, get cut, the game gets canceled, get my first fight in the coast in a preseason game, have to get surgery on my hand. I'm out for 3 months. So this was all just a test. You know, I looked at it, I was like, this is just a test, and I'm going to overcome this. And so, yeah, talk about a memorable, I guess my first fight and my first almost three fights were pretty memorable. But yeah, that's, I go pretty deep into all those and what I was experiencing in the book.
Would you credit like your growth from your time overseas where, like, again, you hit that point you had mentioned multiple times, talking, like you hit that point where it's like, I have nothing to lose. Like, this is just part of the process. I'm not giving up. I'm not giving up on myself. Like, is that kind of where, because again, you even faced adversity on your journey back up, like, you know, missing time. Like, do you kind of owe your time in, you know, overseas kind of hitting that point of like, fuck it?
I think so. But I mean, I think it goes back to even growing up. I grew up in a tiny town in northern Wisconsin called Peshtigo. It's like 3,000 people. And I was literally the only person of color. I was the only brown kid. And I go, identity is a huge theme in my book. Is wondering who I am. Like I'm literally feel different from everybody. And I'm literally I think I was 7 years old. I had a realization. I was like, whoa, because I felt different. I was like, I am different. I was like, this is crazy. I'm different than everybody. And that's where it finally clicked. And that's where I decided, I was like, I'm going to make it all the way. Like I need to be great. Maybe I was trying to prove it to myself or prove my self-worth. But it stemmed from that moment on and, you know, followed through my hockey career, which got me to Division I with that mentality. But then there was a level you could kick it up even more. And I didn't attain that level until that year in Austria when I had, I thank him now, a coach who just maybe, I don't know why, but didn't believe in me, didn't play me. And just a situation where I wasn't playing and I felt just worthless out there. And so all of that combined with just facing fear was that moment where I was like, dude.
Yeah.
I've only really had two of those, really three of those moments in my life. One was when I told you when Coach Bramble, BU, said that to me. Mm-hmm. That was a moment. And then a moment was when I decided I was going to really fight for real and fight my way to the NHL. And then the other moment was when I decided I was going to do this for real and write the greatest sports memoir of all time. That was my goal in writing this.
Dude, so I got to ask you too, you got the Bruins jersey in the background. You know, unbelievable. Obviously, we're local to, you know, in Mass. You know, everyone here knows who you are, obviously. Is there any way, can you speak to your time in Providence? And then can you speak to also the first time that you stepped on the ice for an NHL game? Can you take us through those emotions? You know, the kind of that full circle moment. You know, you mentioned three games. It's three more than a lot of people ever get to play. Can you take us kind of through that experience of your first NHL game?
Yeah, I mean, just having a dream coming back from Europe to say, man, at that point I was like, I want to fight my way to the NHL, but there was another layer inside of my mind that said, if I can just get back to the American League, I will have already proved it to myself that anything's possible. Because it was impossible from how I saw it and how a lot of people saw the situation. But so I fought for two seasons in the East Coast, and then, man, it's the coolest. It was so cool to write about that experience of getting called up to Providence. That was like, man, Providence is like, it's like God's providence. Like somebody was watching out for me and listening to me. And I got called up there, and my first shift, I ended up fighting Ryan Hallweg and just kicked butt in that fight, man. And, it was crazy. And then I just found my home in Providence. I was like, whoa, this team needs me. And everything was just perfect. And Bruce Cassidy loved the way I play, and I could tell he believed in me and played me, and they developed me there. But yeah, just for me to get back to the American League after being in Europe and having given up on my dream. And, you know, I played a full season in the American League with Binghamton, my first year pro. And man, I was just a plug. I didn't do anything. I just sat there on the bench. But then to see, you know, 6 years later, how much I developed as a pro athlete and to be a third line guy in the American League, I was like, it felt good to see it all happen. I was like, okay, this can happen. This can happen. I can accomplish my dreams here if I just keep my focus completely on it. And that I told you that year I got 41 fighting majors. That was during the lockout, which was crazy. I don't even know. I think I blacked out for the whole season. I was just fighting everybody. And then to hear like, hey, Boston just offered you a contract, a 1-year NHL deal. And I was like, I was already 31. And this was before the season even ended. We were still in playoffs. And then I ramped it up even more. I think we were playing against Hershey, the Hershey Bears, and I had a great playoff run. And then they ended up offering me a 2-year contract. And I was like, this is happening, you know? And man, I just feel like for me, it was my whole life has just been battling adversity. Like an adversity comes and I got to overcome it. And I don't know where that comes from. Probably from a lot of life experiences, but you know, on my first year of my NHL contract, I end up, Tom Wilson falls on my knee in my first exhibition game and blows out my knee. Could have been a lot worse. It was just an MCL tear, but you know, I missed 8 weeks, you know, and the word on the street was, Bobby's going to make the team in Boston this year. And, but you know, talk is cheap, right? I'm back in Providence rehabbing my knee. And so that year I took it to the next level. I became like really a machine. And I worked with, I owe a lot to my trainers. You know, it's who are you surrounding yourself with that make you better? And I had an amazing trainer in Mike Macchione. He just trained me and formed my body and my mind. I like to say he turned me into an absolute steak. And then I worked with a fighting coach, Doug Smith, the author of Goon, you know, the real life Goon who fought his way there. And he was my fighting coach. The Bruins hired him as my fighting coach. And so, you know, and having, you know, Bruce Cassidy and Don Sweeney, who was the assistant GM there at the time, they just really believed in me. And I think that really grew up my belief in myself. And then coming into that second year on my contract, I was like, I'm making this team. You want to come and try and take my spot, I will devour you, man, you know?
Yeah.
And so I made the team, and to see that happen, I was like, whoa, the sky really is the limit. And there is a formula of how to achieve success and how to make it happen. And so now that that's happened, it wasn't the ending that I expected, but it was all for, you know, it was all for this, it was all for a bigger purpose. And now even with this project or with writing a book or with whatever comes next with business or anything, I just know that if you follow a game plan and stick to it and give it everything you have and go all in, that I believe that you have to succeed. So yeah, when I got there, it was amazing when they announced the opening day roster, and you know, media's like, man, you're the oldest rookie to ever make an NHL opening day roster, 32 years old. And I was like, man, I feel like I'm 22, man. Yeah. Get out of my way. Let's go. And yeah, so I came in with a lot of piss and vinegar, and you know, just was giving it everything I have and taking the ice that first game. I can't wait for you to read that scene, especially for Boston fans. It's pretty cool. I've shared that out over on my ex or Twitter there on my pinned tweet. You can read about that first game. So it was amazing. It was a fairy tale, but then it quickly turned into a nightmare, unfortunately. And, you know, just kind of fighting through a head injury, fighting through concussion, and then really spiraled quickly into insanity and some pretty dark places. So my trip there to the show, it was awesome. And then, but it ended pretty much as quickly as I got there. And then it was a whole nother set of adversities and tests that I had to overcome.
Yeah. And I mean, look at you now, man. Like you said, every adversity that you faced, you've battled through. Right. And it's unbelievable, but I want to get into, you know, some of the, you know, the game today, you know, fighting and whatnot. You know, what are your thoughts on the game today as a whole, the role of the tough guy, you know, particularly the emergence of guys like, you know, Matt Rempe, who's just going out there and fighting anyone he can. You know, does fighting still have a place in the game in your mind? And again, what are your thoughts on guys like Rempe kind of going out and just kind of, like you said, man, just has nothing to lose and just going at anyone?
I mean, I love it. I would have done the same thing. I think anybody, or maybe not anybody, but a lot of people who are all in are going to do the same thing that Rempe's doing. And I'm rooting for him. I played with Curtis McDermott's brother, Lane McDermott, who is a fighter as well. He's a good buddy of mine, and we were texting yesterday about the fight. And so I know him, and I've met Curtis, and so I was rooting for him. And but at the same time, I've been rooting for Rempe as well. And I mean, is there a place for fighting? Clearly there is, right? I mean, it's a crazy sport, and I think there's a lot of
Line brawl too, man. I was like, holy shit. Like, I mean, I was there for it. I was, although you go on X and like a lot of people are like, you know, get all fired up about it. There's no place in the game for it. But I'm like one of those sickos that like, I was all fired up by it.
I was too. I'm a sicko too. Don't get me wrong here. But yeah, I saw that pop up on my feed. We were actually at, finishing up dinner.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh no. I was like, they fought. I took like 3 minutes. I was like, all right, we got to prepare it. So I'm sitting with my phone and my wife and my kids all around me watching McDermott fight. I mean,
the tough bastard.
Oh man, he's tough. I met him when he was on his last year of junior, and I was looking up to him. I was like, oh man, he's a big dude. I had just retired in 2016. I was like, oh, thank God I don't have to fight a guy like this, man.
Right.
But yeah, that was crazy. I've never seen anything like that before. But yeah, there's a lot of talk, obviously, you know, and I think there needs to be. You know, it's cool. There's a line brawl, but at the same time, last week Chris Simon killed himself, and so I'm kind of on both sides of that, where I lived it and I've been through the darkness too, and would be lying to you now if I said I was completely out of the darkness. And so I have my concerns of you know, for my mind and my health and well-being. And I have buddies. I just had a buddy, a guy who played in the NHL, you know, you'd know who he is. And he got a hold of me last week. He's like, man, I'm really worried. Like, I need to talk to you. Like, what are you doing for this stuff? And I'm like, I don't know, man. But, you know, I know the PHPA, they have a good program going, an assistance program. There's a lot of, I've been on a few of those calls a while ago. But there's a good group of guys on there, you know, Trevor Gillies and Mike Scroy, who are working with the PHPA to help people, and they have a weekly call. Chuck Thuss actually runs that. So I think that there's good resources now, as people know the dangers of fighting, and especially a lot of ex-fighters who are on that call. I think it's really cool. So yeah, I mean, I don't really have an opinion on it, on fighting. I think it's the wildest thing in all the sports. And I mean, I've been in a lot of hockey fights, and nothing really compares to it, especially when you're winning. But yeah, that was crazy to see. And I mean, your original question is, does it still have a part? I mean, I think it still does, man. People, it's a savage sport. And like, anytime you're playing a sport and you know that if you step out of line, a man can physically grab you and throw bones at your face.
Yeah.
That's no joke. And I don't care how tough or brave you are. I was pretty brave and pretty tough, and I still had that fear, you know, going into games. So I think there is a place for it. And that was a crazy response. I knew there was going to be a response. I was hoping there was between Rempe and McDermott. And I had no idea it was going to blow up into a 5-on-5 like that.
Yeah, man. Then you see like Laviolette and Travis Green going at it too. Yeah. I'm like, holy shit, man, this is going to be wild. But, you know, besides, you mentioned McDermott, are there any other guys in the league right now that you know, you really enjoy watching? Doesn't even have to be, you know, a fighter or grinder. Are there any guys that, you know, you kind of turn on the TV for and really enjoy watching?
You know, I have to be completely honest with you. I really don't watch much hockey anymore. I have three kids now, so I don't have a lot of time.
Yeah.
I mean, my extent of hockey watching, I didn't watch one game this year. I usually watch the Stanley Cup finals just because it's the finals, obviously. But I mean, I just watch the highlights, and I watch obviously the fights. I love the fighters, and you know, I love Ryan Reeves, and I love Rempe. I love those big guys. Like, Rempe's not just a goon either, and neither is McDermott. Like, they're, you know, they're effective checkers, and they play a big role in that physicality. So I like watching those guys, and especially guys, you know, like McDermott, who I know, and to see success is always pretty cool. But yeah, I haven't really followed it too much. I mean, I'm obviously rooting for the Bruins, but aside from that, I don't really watch too much hockey until the playoffs, deep into the playoffs.
Yeah. Man, I got a question here from our buddy Nick. Obviously, he was the one who was able to get in contact with you. Huge. He's a huge fan. He's pumped up for the book. This question, looking back on your career and reflecting, it's crazy how fast life can alter course. In regards to you, you've been open about, you know, some of the health scares you've had, from tobacco addiction, concussions. They kind of serve as how, you know, how fragile life is. Beyond the realm of hockey, what wisdom would you give to others, other people who are navigating their own journeys, and going through their own struggles, trying to kind of overcome their own adversity?
Oh, that's a good question, Nick.
Yeah, he was pumped deep. About this one. I wanted this one to be one of the last ones too, because it's a good question.
Yeah, I mean, if I were to answer that question and really be answering that to myself, as a young man, I would say you have to realize, like, what are you? Who are you? Like, what are you even here for? I think I know for myself, and probably for a lot of people, it's so easy to get distracted in the world, you know, with our jobs and our bills and social media and our friends and our wives and girlfriends and whatever, your family. Like, I think it's important for every individual to look themselves in the mirror and really ask those bigger questions and be like, what am I? Am I just meat and bone and I live and I die, or am I something more? And my book goes into some of that. And I guess I would say, are you just on a quest right now for 80 years and that's it? Or are you on a spirit quest? And that's really a big part of my story is what am I? Am I on a spirit quest? If you don't know you're on a spirit quest yet, you're losing the quest, you know? So yeah, I think asking those big questions, without getting into it too much, because I don't want to spoil too much with my book, but with my own quest, but I would just ask those big questions. Try not to be distracted with everything around you. There's a lot of bright lights and everything going on, especially in the technological age that we're living in now, where it's so good just to sit there and meditate, or sit there and pray, and sit there and say, wow, what am I? Who am I? Where am I going? What's the purpose of this? And once you start asking those big questions, if you seek them, you'll find them. You'll find the answers to them. And so that's a big part of my story. After my career ended, I was completely consumed with my identity as a hockey fighter. I was like, by the time I was on that 2-year contract with Boston, I was like, that is who I am. I'm Bobby the hockey fighter. I'm the savage.
Right.
That's who I am. And when that was taken away from me, I had to really look at myself and say, well, who am I now? And it was around that time when everything kind of bubbled up, all these issues I was able to hide under a strong exterior of a professional athlete, one of the toughest athletes in hockey, you know, a fighter in all of sports. Hockey players are the toughest. So once that identity was gone, it was like, well, what am I now? And so those big questions really started me out on my spirit quest of finding out what I am and who I am and why I am. And so that would be my advice to me, giving myself as a young man, like, don't be distracted, find out what's really important and find out what your quest means and that realize that your life matters.
Man, I can't wait for this book. I'm telling you, you know, we got a couple more questions, man. And you kind of went into this, you know, with the player assistance programs that, you know, the NHL has going on. But you personally, man, like, what do you feel the future holds for, you know, mental health awareness, not only in the game of hockey, but just professional sports as a whole? And what changes, if any, would you like to see kind of implemented? And again, this doesn't have to be just directed right at hockey. Could be just professional sports as a whole. In order to better support, you know, the not only just the athletes, but the families as well. You know, after these guys and girls' careers are done, you know, supporting the families as well.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what the answer to that is. I just knowing from my own family and the ups and downs we've had, and you know, my wife. You'll have to get my wife on the podcast. She's looked at it from a whole different perspective. She might have some better wisdom of what would help her out, what she desires to have. But yeah, I think it's important to have a support system. And the worst thing you can do is to feel like you're alone on an island. And I know for myself, I'm kind of a lone wolf. And sometimes when I get in those dark places, I'm just like, shut me up in my room. And but that's not good. And that's actually what I did, you know, when I had my concussion. I just shut myself up. And that's when, you know, the madness came. And so the doctors were like, you need to get out into the world, get social and, you know, use your brain instead of just turning it off. And, yeah, it's a hard situation because I think athletes and hockey players is you live this high stress, but a high reward lifestyle of chasing glory and these huge dreams. And I think when you're done with it, and I've experienced that myself, is you're like, well, nothing's ever going to compare to that, you know, and that's okay. I've come to the point where I'm like, that's okay. I lived that life. What a blessing that was to live that life, a gift. And now I'm living in just a different chapter in my life, you know? So I think it's the acceptance of that, which comes with that, that spirit quest that you're on of sitting there and finding out who you are and why you are and where you are and realizing that it's okay to not have that lifestyle anymore, but now it's on to the next thing. And for me, I know it's been like on to the next thing with this book and on to the next thing with what all these other dreams I have, and just taking the lessons that I learned in my hockey career from climbing the hockey ladder and then learning to implement it. But yeah, having a good support system for sure. I'm blessed to have an amazing wife who supports me and some great friends. But, you know, I'd be lying if I told you I didn't struggle, and I'd be lying if I told you that I didn't know people, my peers, who are struggling as well. So, man, I don't know what the answer is. I saw Dan Carcillo was talking about that today on Instagram. He was saying, like, something about informed consent. Like, these are men out there. Repi's a man. He's a young man who's going for his dream, and he's willing to do anything for it. Like I was. I was willing to die, literally. Like, I'm willing to die for this. And, but just to know, like, hey, if you do this, can you fight smarter? Maybe you don't have to fight wide open all the time. Like, I was always wide open, but maybe I'd be a little more defensive. And just, you know, just, that information of, hey, if you do get your bell rung, probably don't want to get hit again. Cause the cumulative aspect of concussions, really, that's what did me in. It can be devastating. So I think just having that information and having that support system, but man, it's like, I don't have the solution. I don't know what the answer is.
I feel like it's one of those things that it's just hard to, it's one of those things we may never find out. You know right. what I'm saying? Like it's unfortunate, but I think you said it best, man, like Rempe and all these guys, they're willing to die for their dreams. Like all these guys, the Nick Deloriers of the world, the McDermids. And I agree, like, yeah, there are probably things that can be done to kind of alleviate some of that. Like, you know, Matt Rempe going 3 games in a row fighting a heavyweight. It's like, well, maybe take like a night off. You know what I'm saying? Like maybe. Right. But again, yeah, it's hard when you're dealing with, again, grown men that are fighting for their dreams and they're willing to do whatever it takes. Yeah, but man, I cannot thank you enough for taking the time. I'm so glad that we finally got, you know, that here at Drop the Mitts, we got the opportunity to talk to you, man. It's such an honor. You're like our first true fighter that we've had on, our first tough guy. We've had like prospects on. So this is awesome. I mean, we're at an hour and 12 and I could go on all day, man. is there anything else that you want to talk about with the book? Any other notes, you know, things people should look forward to, as far as the book? I know you and I had talked about doing a little giveaway, which I'll put that out on Twitter once you and I can kind of figure out what the, you know, what we're going to do. But, is there anything else that you kind of want to let the people know that are looking forward to your book?
Yeah, I'm very honored to be able to tell my story and share it in this way that I don't think it's ever been done before. So anybody who wants to hear something crazy, a savage memoir, I would be so honored.
Ooh, we might have lost Bobby.
If you would read my story. Hey, there you are.
Oh, there we go, man. Don't worry. I can cut that out. Won't even notice it happened. But
all right, let me say that again.
Yeah, we're good, man.
Yeah. So, I mean, I just, thank you to anybody who's going to read my book. I really poured out every ounce of me into that thing and wrote a savage memoir. And, it's the real deal. Like it's adult content. It's not for kids. I'll read you my warning here on page 1. Right here, I have a warning that says, warning, mature content, adult themes, graphic sexuality, explicit drug use, crude language, ultra violence, exploding bodily fluids, general mayhem, and depictions of insanity that some readers may find disturbing. So obviously that's stylistic and kind of cool sounding, but there is a lot of truth, a lot of truth in that. So this isn't like the sports hero kids book. This is a savage memoir, and it goes as deep as I.
Oh, can you hear
there
me?
You are, you hear me?
I think we yeah,
I hear you.
Yeah, we lost you for a little. We lost you for a little bit, but yeah, definitely not for children. I cannot thank you enough for taking the time. I'm so glad that we were able to link up, and hopefully we can again. Once the book comes out, I'm super fired up to read it. And again, man, everything that you have coming to you is shit you earned. You put yourself out there and you worked your ass off to make this happen. So it's so cool to see, this stuff come to fruition and good things starting to happen for you, man. I'm really excited for you.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Did we lose Bobby? We will give it a second, but I think we might have lost him.
Is he back on the pod here?
Oh, man, can you hear me? We're losing you a little bit. I think we might have lost Bobby. But again, guys, this was an unbelievable interview. And again, that was Bobby Robbins, longtime professional hockey player. Suited up for our Boston Bruins, played some seasons in Providence. Just a completely wild story, which he depicts in his unbelievable book. That's going to be coming out soon. Sex, Drugs, Pucks, and Souls. And again, you guys can purchase that at BobbyRobbins.com. He's got an early bird special. One of 1,000 are going to be signed and personalized. So again, I'm going to try to send him a little invite. I'm going to try to send him one again and see if he can pop back in just for the ending of it. Because I know he really was excited about this and we were too. I mean, such a crazy honor to be able to have Bobby on. And you guys saw just the passion that he has for the game of hockey. Just his incredible, incredible story. So we're going to fire off the link to him. And like I said, he was really getting into, oh, we're good. We've got Bobby back.
Hey, we're back. But,
we're good. Good to go.
Good to go, man. Round two.
Yeah. So, man, if you want to repeat, what you were saying, anything that you want to say about the, your book coming out, obviously, what fans should expect. And like I said, I kind of just went on a little rant there. And I don't know, you didn't get to hear, but just how honored we were to be able to have you on, talk about this book, and see it, see this side of, an NHL athlete.
Oh, for sure, man. I'm blessed to be here. Honored. Thank you so much. And appreciate you supporting me and
getting. Oh, can you hear me, bro? Can you hear me, man?
Yeah, I hear you.
All right, it might be my internet, man, because we just had a big, huge storm.
I bet you, yeah.
But yeah, man, again, we can't thank you enough. Again, that's Bobby Robbins, longtime professional hockey player, author of the new Sex, Drugs, Pucks, and Souls, which will be out soon. He's got an early bird special going on right now for all you guys on X. One of 1,000 will be signed and personalized. I mentioned earlier, we're going to be working to do a little giveaway, you know, where Bobby will address, you know, address the book to you and you'll be able to get that. So again, man, I can't thank you enough. I'm so fired up for this book. Just that one verse, man, I was ready to go. I was ready to get off this and go read. So,
nice.
I can't thank you enough, man. And like I said, we got to get you on the pod again soon. Cause this was a blast.
For sure. I'm in for round two.
Awesome, man. Take care. You know, I'm so happy for you, you know, the wife, your whole family, everything that you're doing, the work that you've put in, you absolutely deserve all the great things that are coming to you. So again, we're fired up for you, brother.
Thanks, Chris, man. I appreciate it. Drop the mitts. Sure. Let's go.
Let's go. So that was Bobby Robbins. You can catch this. This is episode 38. I can't believe we're friggin' 38 episodes in. Again, unbelievable guest, our first true tough guy, unreal. And again, you know, if you guys like this episode, go follow us on whatever platform you use, you know, Spotify, Apple, YouTube, whatever. So yeah, this will be out next week. So yeah, again, follow us on whatever platform, Drop Mitts Hockey. Bobby, if you want to drop your socials too, I actually have them saved on here because I want everyone to, you know, go toss you a follow.
They're the same across all the social media, at Bobby Robbins Pro, BobbyRobinsPro. And you can go to BobbyRobbins.com to order books. Only available from BobbyRobbins.com.
Let's sell
them myself. So
let's go. Let's go. All right, guys. That concludes episode 38. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. You know, and again, thank you guys for always being supportive. Greatly appreciate you. Love you guys. And please stay safe out there in this crazy world we live in. So take care, everyone.